Anne, if we could just for a second chat about your father and Tony Hillerman and the fact that he, as I understand, started as a journalist like you, I guess after World War II when he returned. And,
well, I was a little young to remember
right.
that.
Right.
Yes. But when I was growing up, my dad was working in Santa Fe. He came to Santa Fe to be the bureau chief for United Press International, which was sort of the parallel organization of Associated Press.
Right.
Yeah. And then I guess he'd done that for a couple years. And the editor of the Santa Fe New Mexican, or the publisher of the New Mexican, called him and invited him to become editor there. And so he did that job for maybe 5 years. Yeah, journalism was really, really important to him. And in his book, Seldom Disappointed, he talks a lot about how being a journalist, some ideas that he got from stories he covered, and the whole discipline of writing on deadline, writing concisely, figuring out what's important and what's not important, how all of that really helped him when he switched to writing fiction.
So in that switch, though, that's a big jump going from journalism to a novel. Fictional novel. Do you know anything about that jump that he took and how he made it?
Well, I think like a lot of journalists, he had a dream of writing a novel. And so while he was working in journalism, working at the New Mexican, and it was a big job. He was probably working 6 days a week, going in early, coming home late. After he had dinner, he would retreat to his home office, which was basically just a desk in the bedroom, and, you know, write in the evenings. And he did that regularly, almost every night.
Wow.
So, you know, he had a lot of discipline and he had a lot of drive. He was working on fiction. He also was working on nonfiction stories that he could sell to basically supplement his income as a journalist. So he was doing that. And, you know, he had this dream, and eventually he got a job offer to move to Albuquerque to work for the University of New Mexico. The president then was looking for somebody to be a legislative liaison and also to help coordinate the 75th anniversary for UNM.
Uh-huh.
And he knew my dad because he met my dad as, you know, when he had come down to lobby with the legislature. So he offered my dad this job, and my dad was really torn because he loved journalism. And so he talked it over with my mom, and my mom said, you know, if you really want to move on to writing fiction, you never will be able to do it as a journalist. You just can't, you won't have the freedom. So she said, if you, moving down to the university would give you, you know, extra, the money wasn't so good, but the time part was good. And she said, I would be willing to go to work. At that point, I think there were five of us kids. She said, I would be willing to go to work to help support our family because I know this is really important to you. And I think, you know, I know you would love to do it, and I know you would do a fine job. So my dad left journalism then and moved. He started working at the university. I think it took them, I think that was in January, and it took him until May to sell the house or something like
right.
that. So there was a time
right.
when he was commuting. But yeah, he moved to Albuquerque. He did a little stint in public relations, got his master's, and then began teaching journalism, eventually became chairman of the department
right.
there. So he never really lost his connection to journalism.
Right.
But moving to the academic branch of journalism then gave him the freedom to work on novels.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I don't want to say, it sounds bad to say academic, because part of his real passion in teaching journalism was that the faculty should be people who had actually worked as journalists, not just people who had learned journalism from reading textbooks.
Yeah.
And he was adamant about that. And I bet during the time that he was a professor, all of his graduates were really highly regarded, and well, I shouldn't say all because it's never all, but most of them really highly regarded by newspapers all across the state, you know, snapped up like crazy, and they did really, really well.
Wow.
So.
Do you recall ever hearing any stories about his early childhood life and write
about? Lots of stories about reading.
Yeah.
Not so much about writing. That's really interesting. I don't remember him ever talking about writing as a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of reading. He and his brother and sister would get books. They lived in this little podunk town in Oklahoma.
Right.
So they would get books that was before bookmobiles. It was books by mail from the state library. Ah. And they would send in their requests, the Bobbsey twins, yeah. Nancy Drew, whatever it was. And they would get back the history of geology in Oklahoma, fundraising strategies by the American Red Cross, all of these kind of bizarre things. and my dad said, he said, in a way, it was really good that we got all those books. He said, we would have read anything. You know, we were desperate. Yeah. He said, and it really, you know, kind of opened my eyes to how much was in the world, things I never would have thought about reading. And I think the same was true for his brother and sister.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then when he was serving in World War II, this is, I guess, the first stories that I heard about his writing. He would send letters home to his mom, you know, from the front, and he wouldn't, of course, write about the gory stuff, but right. he would, you know, write about, you know, things that he saw. He tried to keep them light and funny, and, yeah. you know, he'd write to her as often as he could. So he was injured in the war. He won the Purple Heart, yeah. and Silver Star.
And
the Bronze Star. So a reporter at the Daily Oklahoman received a news release from the Army. Said, you know, local boy makes good, comes right. back a hero. So she contacted my grandmother and said, you know, what can you tell me about your boy? I want to do a little story on him. And my grandmother said, well, instead of me telling you, he's sent me all these letters, I'll just take the letters down to you.
Wow, neat.
Yeah, so my grandmother went down to the newspaper office and gave the reporter, her name was Beatrice Stahl, gave her all these letters. So then Miss Stahl called my dad in and interviewed my dad, and after the interview, she said, "Well, what are you going to do now?" And my dad said, "Well, I guess I'll, you know, go back to college. I've got the GI Bill." And she said, "Well, what do you think you're going to study?" He said, "Well, I was studying, I think it was either chemistry or engineering." And she said, "Well, do you like it?" And he said, "Well, you know, not particularly." And she said, "Well, I think you have a real gift as a writer." She said, "I love reading your letters. I think you're a natural storyteller."
Amazing.
She said, "If I were you, I would really think about going into journalism. It'll give you a great chance to write. You'll meet interesting people." And it was just one of those, like you have in fiction, one of those turning right. points where an idea that had never occurred to him, I mean, really a gift, not only to my dad, I think, but to all of us who yeah. love his stories, you know.
Who was this again?
Her name was Beatrice Stahl. She was a reporter for the Daily Oklahoman.
Amazing.
Yeah.
A real turning point person.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
incredible.
Yeah.
Most of the writers we've spoken with can trace their real start to one person who sort of directed their attention or encouraged them or berated them or something,
yeah.
that one person made that leap for them.
Yeah. And I think that person probably has to be somebody who's not your parents.
I don't think that's ever been said by anybody. Many of them wanted them to become doctors, lawyers, or say anything other than
go into
lawyers.
Some real job.
Get a real job.
Yeah.
Right. So your father would work in the bedroom at a desk.
Right.
And did writing in longhand on any, you have any?
Oh, he had a typewriter. You know, in journalism, you write on typewriters. So, yeah. Things were on typewriters. I mean, he did keep notebooks, you know, that were handwritten, you know, ideas, situations. He also, you asked me about reading. He, all through his life, he was an avid reader. When he was working at the New Mexican, one of his people he worked with told me this later, that in his bottom desk drawer, he had all of these Raymond Chandler novels. And, and you know, when there were slow times, he would read them, and not only read them, but read them and take notes.
Yeah.
So he was reading not only for the pleasure of reading, but also reading analytically to see how does he do this? How does he build suspense?
Well, there is a story that there's another Australian writer, English-Australian writer, that he describes as having been sort of an inspiration for his ideas.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
I think his name was Upfield.
Right.
Is that right? Yeah, and he had a detective who was an Aboriginal native,
yeah.
and this guy is solving crimes. And I mean, that impressed Dad, because yeah. not only was the crime getting solved, but you were learning something about the culture of Australia and something
right.
about Indigenous people, and the fact that it wasn't your average white guy.
Right.
with a drinking problem. You know, it was more, I mean, well, you right. know, as was true
yeah.
in the 40s. I mean,
yeah.
that was the real model for detectives,
yeah.
that this was somebody off the charts.
And journalists.
Yeah, right, right. But, you know, this was a guy off the charts, and it made the books, at least my dad thought, made the books a lot more interesting.
Now, So your father gets involved with primarily Navajo cultures and the amazing mythologies and all of that. Did he go out and research? Did he go to the reservations to research? Do you know how he...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. His first exposure to the Navajos was right after the war, and he loved to tell this story. He had come back. He was injured, so he wasn't able to do like a lot of hard work, and he had this girlfriend who he'd met, I think, at the UFO club, and so her dad was in the business of supplying oil drilling company, and he was taking equipment,
right,
out to the Navajo reservation, to a place near Crown Point. And he needed somebody to go along and drive a truck or something. So he hired my dad. So my dad was out there with him, and as they were on the reservation, he saw a group of young Navajo men on horseback in ceremonial regalia going somewhere. And so he stopped and asked about it, and the guy he talked to at the trading post said, oh yeah, those are some of our young men who've just come back from the war. And so there's going to be an enemy way ceremony, a ritual to welcome them back into the community and to help them get over whatever kind of traumatic things have happened to them during the war. I'm sure they didn't use the word trauma back in the 40s, but it was PTSD in, you know, version 2.1. So anyway, my dad went to that ceremony, and he often said that that was really the start of his love affair with the Navajo culture.
Interesting.
That he was so impressed by, not only by the ceremony itself and the music and the dancing, but by the fact that this culture, unlike his culture, really acknowledged that there was some healing to be done on these young men and was going, making an extra step to really welcome them back into the community.
Amazing.
Yeah, and then when he was at the university, he had Navajo students, and he had access to a lot of materials that were in the Zimmerman Library, so all of that. And then living in Santa Fe or in Albuquerque, he wasn't so far from the landscape he was writing about.
Wow. Well, I have to ask, apart from you, obviously, were there other writers that your father inspired or got for besides journalists? I mean, novelists?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, clearly he had an impact on you.
Yeah, I can't even tell you how many. My mom and I, after my dad died, one of our jobs was to kind of go through stuff and figure out what to keep and what to get rid of. And I bet we did 10 or 12 boxes of books that had been dedicated to my dad, either by former students at UNM. He was very much involved in the writing community in Albuquerque. There was a group called First Fridays, where writers of all different levels, all different experiences, would just meet and basically shoot the breeze. I'm not sure if they'd actually have a person doing presenting or if it was totally just roundtable informal. And then he said yes to almost every invitation he got to go to writers' conferences, to talk at universities. And when he would be doing those talks, of course, people would come up to him and they'd say, oh, I've got this manuscript and blah, you know. And my dad would always say yes. And he would, I think sometimes he would say, I read your manuscript. I can see you have a lot of passion. Keep up the good work. And I think sometimes if it was a person who really showed some talent and looked like there was hope for them, that then he might say, you know, I really like this character. I think you could do more with him. I think he would give them more specific advice if it looked like somebody who was serious about their writing.
Fascinating. Do you recall him ever sort of running out of the bedroom saying, listen, you got to hear what this is, what I just wrote?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark Twain did that all the time. He had his daughters stationed listening to him excitedly talk about something he just wrote.
Yeah.
That's neat. He had joy in what he did.
Yeah.
Is that infectious? Did it wear off on you?
Oh, yeah. I don't think you can grow up with somebody who has that much affection and not be touched by it.
Right. You say he worked on a typewriter, but he also happened to live through the change in technology to computers. Did he ever make the leap? Did he get a computer?
I think he got sort of pushed into the abyss. It wasn't a happy leap. Technology was not his forte.
Yeah.
It was so, I mean, and that wasn't just true with computers. I mean, it was true with anything, with fixing anything that went wrong. Technology was not his friend.
Oh, me too.
But I think, he realized writing on a computer would make things quicker, would make would make everything go better. And finally, you know, his editors just basically, you know, said, no, you've got to go to computer.
Very good.
So he did. But he was just so much more interested in the story than in the technology that he would forget to save things or he would forget what he had called it. Or I mean, just any possible thing you can think of going wrong with computers, went wrong with computers and left him endlessly frustrated.
That's great. Yeah.
So you brought some books with you here. Can you talk about some of these?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Well, I'll talk about this one. This is my newest book. And my husband, here it is. My husband, Don Strell, and I did this book together. And this book was really inspired by my dad and inspired by a conference that Don and I and our business partner started to honor my dad.
When was that? When did you start?
Oh, you would ask me that. I think it was 2005.
Okay.
Or maybe 2004 or 3. Anyway, it was a long time ago.
You're right.
And one of our speakers was the New Mexico writer Michael McGarrity. Michael writes mysteries that are set in the southern part of New Mexico. And he was doing a talk as our keynote talk about the importance of place in his work. So Don, my husband, who's a professional photographer, said, you know, it would be really cool to show photos of the places that you write about. Even though your book is fiction, you know, you're going to talk about how you're inspired by real places. And Michael said, oh yeah, if you want to do that, fine. So Don went out and got a lot of pictures of sites that were in Michael's book. And the talk was a big success. And my dad was there. And so afterwards, my dad came up to Don and he said, you know, that was really great. I loved all those slides. Why don't you do something like that for my books?
Well,
and it was like a million megawatt light bulb going off over our heads. It's like, yeah, why don't we do that? So I read through all 19 of Dad's books. Yeah. And one thing people have always loved about my dad's books is the way he makes the scenery almost a character.
Very.
He has those wonderful scenes where Jim Chi and Joe Leaport have to pull off the road because they just cannot drive and take in the vast, wonderful landscape at the same time.
Right.
So I read through the books looking for those quotes. And then Don and I came up with a huge list, and then Don went out to find the places where they had pulled off the road so we could have those pictures in our book. And I know Dad said that sometimes people would come up to him and they'd say, you know, we really like your books, but you kind of overdo it with all these landscape descriptions. And we're thinking, well, yeah, people who live where all you see are trees and gray, they don't understand it really looks like that. So we thought, yeah, we would get those pictures. So anyway, we worked, when we came up with the idea, I thought also it would be really wonderful to have my dad go with us when we went to these places.
Oh, nice.
Because, you know, seeing the landscape always inspires stories.
Yeah.
And he had often said that when he was working on a book and he got a little stuck, he would go out to the places he was writing about, and inevitably the idea of moving from the office, from the computer, to the location would shake up whatever had been frozen and help him, you know, work more fluidly again. But at that point in his life, he just wasn't really up for it. He and his brother, Barney Hillerman, had done another photo book. And he said he remembered very well being in the car with Barney and how they would be in one place for an hour waiting for the light to shift, or how he would be in the car and Barney would be doing this angle, doing that angle.
Right.
I mean, he said it very politely, but no.
Yes.
The answer was no.
Yeah.
He said, when you come back, show me your pictures.
Yeah.
So we would do that. And whenever we would show him the picture, he always would say, now this is the one that should be the cover. So we had like 15 covers, but we did show him this cover. And he loved this picture, this sunset
beautiful.
Picture.
Beautiful.
And so that got to be on the cover.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love this book. So we were working on this book, and it was coming along pretty well. I had HarperCollins, my dad's publisher, bought it because I thought it would be a lot easier to get permission for the quotes using the same publisher my dad had used.
Right.
So it's coming along, and then my dad died. And my deadline was, a year from when he died. And so they called me. They were nice enough. I think they gave me 2 or 3 weeks. And then they called me and they said, you know, we really would like to get that book out as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And I couldn't blame them.
Sure.
So I said, sure.
Timing is everything.
Yeah. So then I got to work on it, and I turned in different copies. And my editor was really sweet, and she said, you know, I really like this. You're doing so well here, but I think it needs to be a little more personal. And, you know, as a journalist, you are not used to writing personal. And even though I'd been writing reviews, so I was a little more used to it than when I'd been writing straight news, still the idea of writing, getting personal was tough. Right. But she was a very good editor, and she would, like, encourage me. When she saw glimpses of personal, she would, like, give me lots of praise. And so eventually I got to write more and more personally about my dad. And then she, of course, wanted me to write a chapter about my dad dying, because originally I, you know, kind of finished it without that part. And she's, you know, of course we have to write that. So, but it was good. I mean, I felt satisfied with it in the end. Of course, there's always, with any book, there's always things you could do better, could do differently. But all in all, I was pleased with it. And I wish Dad had been around to see it, but yeah. I think he saw enough of it. He wrote the introduction to it. So, you know, we were cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we started our conference, we set up something called the Tony Hillerman Prize. And it's a $10,000 prize for best first mystery. When we started the conference, we thought it would be nice to do something big in honor of my dad. So I met with the folks at St. Martin's Press. They publish a lot of mysteries, and they also do a lot of prizes. And they were interested in working with us. So we came up with what we called the Tony Hillerman Prize. And the idea was it should be for a writer who had never published a mystery. They could have published poetry, nonfiction, whatever, but never written a mystery, should be set in the Southwest, and should be sort of in the spirit of my dad's books. Yeah. Meaning, you know, not a lot of gory violence or graphic sex or aliens coming in to solve the crime. You know, more the kind of traditional mystery. So the first year we did it, we had, I think, about 200 entries.
Wow.
And the one that the judges liked the best was this one called The Replacement Child by a writer named Christine Barber. So St. Martin's kept everything real close to the chest. They wouldn't tell us organizing the conference who had won. They didn't want
any... So they were the judges.
They were the judges. Okay. Well, actually, we suggested judges, and they suggested judges, but they made the final call. The judges reviewed all the manuscript. Each judge picked maybe his or her favorite one or two, and then the editor came up. So anyway, the editor at St. Martin's picked this book. And as it turned out, Christine Barber was working, or had just left the New Mexican, where my dad had worked as editor. And she'd written this book. It was set in Santa Fe and in Taos. It was just the perfect book.
Had she ever met him?
She had never met him, but she had moved to New Mexico because of his book. She'd been living in Florida and was just burned out. And her first newspaper job in New Mexico had been in Gallup, where she was covering the Navajo Reservation.
Interesting.
So, I mean, if we had come up with a scenario of who the winner should be, we could not have done better than Christine.
That's nice. Your conference, then, is annual. What time of year is it?
It's second weekend in November.
And how many people as a
rule? We usually get about 100 people. They tend to be fairly committed writers, not like ready to be committed, but people who are serious about their writing. A lot of them are people who've been writing professionally, say in public relations, in corporate communications, scientific writing, but they're just really eager to go into fiction. Or people who've written a lot of fiction, but they want to go to the next level. Instead of writing for their parents and their relatives or publishing it through, you know, Publisher America, they want to go with mainstream publishing. So they tend to be people who are really ready to listen. And our faculty, the traditional model for conferences is you get like big name people from New York or LA, and you spend a lot of money to bring them in, and then you spend a lot of money buying hotel rooms for them, and then you bring people in from elsewhere to listen to these people from elsewhere. Well, we thought New Mexico has so many wonderful writers that we would try to take advantage of the legacy that my dad had left in terms of your question earlier about encouraging writers. So we try to have our faculty people from New Mexico or Arizona or Colorado, so they're not from faraway states. And New Mexico, in fact, has a lot of big-name writers like my dad.
Oh, yeah.
And then the idea was we would bring people from elsewhere, students from elsewhere, so then they could discover our beautiful state, spend their money here, and also make it easy for people who live in New Mexico to get first-rate, go to first-rate workshops, get some inspiration and some practical tips without having to pay for plane fare and lodging and house sitters and dog sitters, you know, somewhere else. So that's been our model, and it's worked pretty well.
So, Anne, either answering from yourself and your experience as a writer and a journalist, and or answering on behalf of your father, Joe Blow walks up to you off the street and says, I have the best idea for a book. What do you tell them?
That's a hard question. Well, it kind of depends on who Joe Blow is. Right. If Joe Blow is a guy who, say, is working for KOB Radio, I might say, why don't you sit down and try to put your story on paper? Because I would figure if he was in radio, he would know a good story, but he might not know how to write a good story. If Joe Blow was somebody who say, was an academic person, you know, I would say, who do you want to read your story? And then maybe talk to him about genres, about tone, blah, blah, blah. Whoever it was, I think I would encourage them to think of who the ultimate reader was. You know, did they want to write the story just because it was a story they had to write, or did they want to write the story with the perhaps mistaken idea that they would be making money selling it?
Unfortunately, too often the case.
Yeah. And if they felt strongly about it, I would encourage them to sit down and do it. If it's I think I would say, if this is important to you, you have to make it a priority in your life. You have to look at how you spend your time and do it. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what all good writing is about.
Yeah.
Even poetry.
Did your dad ever tell you kids stories?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah. We were always, I mean, bedtime stories were just a real part of our family culture. And we were always the heroes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were the ones. And they were always adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, he was a great storyteller.
That's great.
Actually, he came from a big family of storytellers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mentioned earlier, he grew up in this little town in Oklahoma.
Right.
And his dad owned the general store. And he often talked about how, you know, back in the old days, in the 1930s in Oklahoma, that was the center of social activity. So a lot of these old coots would just sit around, you know, and tell each other stories. And as a young man and a small boy, my dad would overhear that. And I think that made a very strong impression on him.
I have visions of them with their feet up at the Cracker Barrel.
Around
the fire. So that's incredible. So someone wants to go to your conference. How do they find out about it?
It's easy. They just go to the website. The name of the company is Word Harvest. Or if they Google up Tony Hillerman Conference,
great,
we'll come up.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the... I feel like I was enormously lucky to have had the parents I had. And after my dad died, Don and I, my hubby, went around and we developed a slideshow. You can kind of see it. He has beautiful photos in this book.
We'll get pictures.
And so we developed a slideshow based on this book. And we would go around and, you know, people were very gracious. And afterwards, people would ask questions. And the question people always asked me was, did your dad have another manuscript? Was there a book in his computer? Was there is there another Jim Chi Joe Lee Porn book that's going to come out? And no, he didn't. He really took care of business. You know, by the time he died, he had used it up, which was the way all of us want to go.
Right.
And so, but people kept asking this question, and people would, and then when I would say no, they would say, oh, I love those characters, I'm so sorry. And as I was doing the conference, a couple writers I worked with at the conference were mystery writers. And even before Dad died, they said to me, you know, you ought to talk to your dad about doing the series with him. You know, he's not going to be around forever. People love these characters. You know, there is precedent for, you know, writers and children doing books together.
Right.
But I mentioned it to Dad, but I think at that point he was pretty much at the end. He knew exactly what he wanted to write, and he didn't need my help. And, you know, I mean, he was happy to talk to me about it, but he wrote by himself.
Right.
But the idea of people loving the series, and I loved it too, and I miss those characters.
Yeah.
Me too.
And so gradually this idea sort of started festering in me, and I thought, I had written a couple other fiction things that are nowhere to be seen by anybody but me.
Right.
But I thought, you know, it would be kind of fun just to see what, you know, what would be the next stage. And one of Dad's characters was a woman named Bernadette Manuelito, and he doesn't ever really do a whole lot with her. Once in a while, she comes up with some good ideas, but mostly she's getting rescued. And I even said to Dad, after Skeleton Man, I said, you know, Bernie almost got to act like a real cop in this book, but then in the end, she gets to be rescued by Jim Chi. And Dad said, well, yeah, you know, Chi and Leaphorn, they're my guys, and yeah, I like Bernie, and you know, maybe someday I might do something, but I could tell he wasn't really going to do it. But that idea stuck in my mind, so after time went by, I thought, well, if I'm going to do anything with the series, I need to write a book where Bernie gets to save the day. Instead of Bernie being the one who's rescued, Bernie is the one who solves the crime.
Wonderful.
So that was what I did, and I called my novel Spider-Woman's Daughter, and it's going to be out in October.
Exciting.
It is exciting. I'm kind of nervous about it because there's such big shoes to fill. But I think, I mean, this is my book, and people will like it or they won't like it, but I did the best I could with it, and I'm proud of it. And I think Dad would have liked it. So there.
I can't. So there.
Yeah.
Right. And I can't help but think that it's not big shoes that need to be filled. It's big high heels that need to be filled. Man, this has been so special and wonderful. This is just, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to meet with us and share your stories.
Well, what could be more fun than to talk about my dad and to talk about writing? It's just been a pleasure.
And what you're doing to encourage others to continue writing. Not to mention taking on a tradition and going on with it.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. It's been wonderful.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right.